Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is hour two. I'm going to be joined in just a second by Thomas J. DiLorenzo. We're going to talk about his brand new book, which is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics. And we're going to talk about this recent Anti-Inflation Act. Yeah, we're going to talk about that in just a second. And 87,000 IRS agents, because we certainly need that. Before we get to that, we got to talk about this whole thing with Mar-a-Lago very quickly. And I'm going to tell you what I think is going to happen. So, you know, this morning there, well, yesterday, Merrick Garland, while I was on the show, you know, he made his announcement that he indeed did authorize this. So he is putting himself out there as the guy who asked for this. We've already talked about the magistrate judge, Bruce Reinhart, who then, you know, signs off on it. So this morning, they released kind of a little inventory of supposedly what they found. And that was 20 boxes of items. This was in the Wall Street Journal. And this happened, I guess, about 10:30 my time. So I guess that's 1:30 on the East Coast. About 20 boxes of items, binders of photos, a handwritten note, an executive grant of clemency for Roger Stone, a list of items. I think there was also something about a list of information about the president of France. Anyway, long story short, from what I can tell, from what I can see, I don't think they've got anything yet that would really be what they would need to kind of justify this thing. Now, that doesn't, of course, that never stops them. And I'm seeing Politico's already saying that, you know, the FBI search warrant shows Trump under investigation for potential obstruction of justice, Espionage Act violations. Well, there's a key word in there, and that key word is potential. I mean, have we not seen this many, many, many times? Now, some people that are pro-Trump or around Trump are saying, guess what? He's already declassified all of that. And they could have had it anytime they wanted, which is interesting, because if you were worried about nuclear documents, would you have let it sit at his house for a year and a half? No. That's what you do with Hunter Biden's laptop, but that's not what you would do with nuclear secrets. So I don't think this is going to pan out. It's just going to be a big dramatic show that they're going to use, because really all they want to do is try to gum things up and prohibit him from running. I don't think it's going to work, and I'll tell you what I think ends up happening. The guys that are going to take the fall for this are going to be Merrick Garland and this Judge Bruce Reinhart guy. Because Merrick, you know, I mean, he's already stood up and said, yep, I authorized this. This magistrate judge, Bruce Reinhart, you know, we pointed out the fact that, wow, if this was a movie, you probably wouldn't do this because it would be too predictable. They find some guy in South Florida who wants represented, you know, Epstein employees. And of course, that's red meat to a lot of people. I understand that. But I think it's also possible that who knows what they have on this Bruce Reinhart character. And in both cases, if somebody has to fall on their sword or someone has to take the fall for this, I think it's going to be those two guys. Not that anything will really happen to them. It's just, I think this is what's going to end up happening. This is going to be a lot of to-do about nothing. I think Trump probably knew that. And I mentioned SCIF earlier, so I'm going to reveal what that is in the third hour, but you might want to try to figure that out. What is a SCIF? And how does this relate to it? And why is nobody bringing this up in any of this? So just a little brain teaser there for you, and stick around for the third hour. We'll talk about that. You guys, if you love what we're doing here at TNT, we need your continued support. And, you know, follow us on social media, share us with your friends, tell your family about it. If you happen to agree with kind of our points of view, or you just find us interesting, or maybe just entertaining, because we do try to entertain you and inform you simultaneously. Share us with your friends and your family, and, you know, download the app. We've got a great app. It functions perfectly. So all of those things that you would expect from a top-notch media organization, we are delivering to you, and we want your support. This is for you here at TNT Radio.
Digging deeper into the news.
It's the topics that matter to me.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, it's time to get down to brass tacks. As I said, it's time to talk about money. And I've mentioned so many, many times in the past, I'm a stone cold capitalist. And we're going to speak with Thomas DiLorenzo. He has a brand new book that we're going to be discussing. It is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics, which means to me, we can talk about it and in terms that we can all understand. And Thomas has written many, many books, and I'm looking for, here it is, right in front of me. I have too many notes, you guys. Thomas J. DiLorenzo is a research fellow at the Independent Institute, a former professor of economics at Loyola University in Maryland. He's a senior fellow of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. We're going to get into that. He received his PhD in economics from Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, and he has taught at the State University of New York. He's written many, many books, including one, How Capitalism Saved America, The Untold History of Our Country from Pilgrims to the Present, amongst many more. Thomas, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be with you, Mark. Michael, how are you?
Hey, man, it's Friday. We're coming bearing down on the weekend, and but we got to talk about this Inflation Reduction Act thing, because color me skeptical. Typically, when we have these kind of things, whatever the title says, it ends up doing kind of the opposite. Your thoughts on the Inflation Reduction Act?
Yes, it does exactly the opposite of what it says. And for example, one big part of it, as you know, is additional hundreds of billions of dollars of additional government spending. And that will pump up demand in the economy. And this is typical for right before an election, by the way. Economists call it the political business cycle. You know, both parties typically go on a big spending binge right before the election to make themselves look popular. But that will increase demand throughout the economy, which pushes up prices, not down. At the same time, they tax production with higher corporate taxes, including taxes on energy, which means gas and other forms of energy will be more expensive, and that makes everything more expensive. So they're going to reduce supply in the economy by doing that, by taxing production. You know, anything you tax, you get less of. That's why the government has sin taxes on alcohol and tobacco. They claim that they want to deter alcohol and tobacco, so they have heavy taxes on it, and it does work. But they're doing the same thing with energy and production in general. So increased demand and decreased supply is going to raise prices, not drop prices. So that's a farce to even call it inflation reduction.
I mean, I have people who know economics on here occasionally, and that's all I'm getting for the last couple of months is like, this is how we got here in the first place, and now you're going to do the same thing again, which will just create, you put more money into the system, you create demand. Well, that's how inflation happens in the first place, so we're chasing our tail here.
Yeah, well, a lot of the reason for calling it inflation reduction not only is because people are worried about inflation, is that it's, a lot of this is the Green New Deal in disguise. Because a lot of what they're doing is funding this pipe dream of, you probably know that the former chief of staff of the congresswoman who calls herself AOC is the author of the so-called Green New Deal when he worked for her. And he said, he's on the record, you can find it on the web, that he said that it's really not about environmentalism at all. It's about essentially going down the road of destroying American capitalism and replacing it with government planning and or socialism, in other words. And so that's the author of the Green New Deal. And this is a lot of the money spent on this bill is a contribution toward moving in that direction.
Because part of it is supposedly we're going to get these tax breaks on solar panels and electric cars and things. But a tax break on a car that most people can't afford anyway, because I'm not in the market for an electric car. And most of the cars that I've bought in my adult life, I think, most of them have been used cars. You know, I'm not poor. I'm just a middle class guy, but I don't buy brand new cars. So I'm certainly not going to buy a brand new electric car. And so these tax breaks for buying the electric car, I mean, I don't know what they amount to, but I'm guessing it's trivial.
It's really, it's throwing a few crumbs to the peasants,
right.
Really is what it is. And even so, you know, I have a relative who owns a Tesla, and she came to visit. It was a 500-mile ride, and she had to stop four times to recharge in 500 miles. And you know, the charging stations use fossil fuels to generate electricity. And so it's not even clear that that it's going to be that much of a savings of fossil fuels, because we're going to have to have an expansion of the use of fossil fuels to generate all that electricity at all these charging stations that they want to build.
It is remarkably backwards. And in some places, they don't have enough of the charging stations, and that puts additional drag on the grid. I've told this story on the show before, but a couple of months ago, people were wanting to come home from Vegas on a Sunday. Guess what? They had to wait in line at these charging stations sometimes for a couple of hours because the demand to use the charging station, there was too much for all the people wanting to come home from Vegas. So it is it's not as great an idea as people think it is. And a lot of people that have EVs, they say, you know what? Been there, done that, more hassle than it's worth, not going to get another one.
It's like a mobile department of motor vehicles being in an electric car and having to stand in line at a charging station just to go another 50 miles.
Yeah, so that's part of it. Okay, so they're going to, you know, they're promising everybody that they're going to give them these tax breaks on the EVs and the solar panels and other things. Another thing that you talk about in the book is whenever government tries to control pricing, it never works. And yet that's part of this thing is supposedly government's now going to negotiate the prices with the drug companies for us. But I think really, I was at the gym this morning, they've got CNN on, and that's the only way I ever watch CNN. But they've got it on, and one of the little things across the bottom basically says it really only applies to like 10 drugs. It'll be expanded in the future. And listen, I'm not pro Big Pharma, but you talk a lot about in the book how when government tries to control prices or deal with pricing, they always blow it.
Well, sure they do. They always blow everything, not just messing around with prices, because after all, they have no stake in the game. Politicians who want to impose price controls or rent controls or whatever, if it turns into a disaster, it's no skin off their back. But if a business person has bad pricing policies, he's pricing too high and he has no customers, well, then he loses money. And if he prices right and prices competitively, he makes money. But so there's a market feedback mechanism in the free market, but in government, there isn't. In fact, what usually happens when the government gets involved in pricing, they'll want to make themselves popular by saying, we're going to drop the price of something like rent or the price of some product. And that'll create shortages inevitably, because at lower prices, people want more. But also at lower prices, it's not as profitable to sell and produce and sell the product. And so you get shortages. And then mm-hmm. the government typically will double down and say, well, we need to put price controls on the inputs, the things that we use to make this product. And so they'll do that. They'll put a price controls on that. And then we'll have shortages of that thing. And today we call it supply chain problem, as we call it, you know, that's the language we're using. But that's what happens. That's the whole history of the Soviet Union, was one big carnival of government trying to impose prices and not relying on just buyers and sellers negotiating price, in the marketplace.
One of the things that you do that's amusing and a nice little thought experiment, you talked about teaching a class, and you asked your class, okay, so what is a famous Russian-made product or that's first in class that came from Russia? And tell us that a little bit right quick.
Well, yeah, I was teaching an MBA class at Loyola University in Baltimore. This is way back in the early 90s, right after the collapse of socialism in the Soviet Empire. And I had an army officer in the class who was working on an MBA degree. There was Aberdeen Proving Ground Army training camp not too far from where I taught. And anyway, he asked about the Soviet economy. And so I asked him, well, can anyone think of any one product in 70 years that was competitive on world markets? And this guy said AK-47s. And I had explained to him the way the system worked, though, is because they didn't have private property and they didn't allow private enterprise, and the government controlled everything. We have no idea. They may have spent $50,000 to build one AK-47, but then they would have to sell it on the world market for whatever the going price was, which would maybe $1,000. And so they would lose $49,000 on every one. Yeah, it's a good weapon, but they didn't make money on it. It was grossly unsuccessful. And another student said caviar, which comes from a fish. It wasn't produced. And the Russians almost destroyed the sturgeon population with pollution, by the way. They almost destroyed the caviar business during communism.
I speak with Thomas DiLorenzo, and we're talking about economics. We're talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, his new book. We're going to take our first break of the hour, and we will be right back here on TNT.
You should hear what Brian McLean is talking about.
The fallout, the supply chain, the financial fallout, this stuff is all just marching onward, all completely marching onward, all in the name of defending the perfect utopian democracy that exists in Ukraine. That's what we're told they have. And we all have to suffer at the pump. We have to suffer via supply chains. We have to suffer watching hyperinflation happen and recession set in while we send billions of dollars over to support the utopia of Ukraine. All right.
Brian McLean on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I view Al Sharpton as a poverty pimp.
Terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland.
I walk outside every day in fear of white supremacy right here in the middle of the hood. Okay, yeah, right.
My grandparents had a cross burned on their property. We were slaves in the past. We're free now.
I never seen a white supremacist in my life. Never, and they can't point to one. Where the hell are they? I wish somebody would introduce me to a white supremacist. I would like to talk to them and take pictures with them because I never seen one in my life.
Biden says that the country is systematically racist. You know, I almost want to look at him and say, haven't you been the system for the last 50 years?
He's the one that sponsored the 1994 crime bill, which unequivocally basically targeted black men in black neighborhoods.
The polarization. The left versus right, the black versus white.
Pro-choice against pro-life.
I work for Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry that I scared you.
People have had to make it like they're apologizing for their whiteness.
And could you just please apologize for, you know, for your white privilege?
What's more disheartening to me is that those who are within the black community are allowing for that to take place.
So really what we're dealing with is a cultural Marxism that Joe Biden and all the rest from the left we're trying to inculcate into our society.
Well, you were once the oppressor, so now I must be the oppressor. You don't avenge evil for evil.
It's okay to say disparaging things against white people. Our former president, Barack Obama, said it, you know, about old white men are a problem. Except when it comes time for him to fly around on their airplanes and ride around on their yachts or be their next door neighbors or endorse them for president like Joe Biden. Then old white men are okay. This is their last gasp.
What do progressive socialists really want?
Watch Systematic Deception at salemnow.com.
Democracy in Action. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We are talking about the Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics. It's by Thomas J. DiLorenzo. He's my guest this hour. And Thomas, some of the things that we try to do on the show is try to contextualize the issues of the present by digging back into the past and trying to understand things that maybe people didn't know. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, looking at all my notes, because I got a lot of things I want to ask you, but who was, because people need to know this. I'm a big Ron Paul fan, and that's how I heard this name for the first time. Who was Ludwig von Mises, and what was he all about?
Well, he was one of Ron Paul's heroes, intellectual heroes. Yep. He was probably the most famous economist in early 20th century Europe. He was a very prominent critic of socialism in Russia and Nazi Germany, and he was the biggest defender of capitalism. He wrote a great treatise called Human Action that is still you can get it online now under from the Mises Institute, MISES.org, which I'm associated with.
Yes,
and He was Jewish, and he was a critic of the Nazis. And so he had to leave town. He fled his apartment in Vienna. He had been in Vienna literally hours before the Gestapo broke in and confiscated all of his papers and everything. He wandered around Europe for a while. And somehow he and his wife got on a boat and ended up in New York City in the late 30s. And he taught classes at NYU, New York University, until he died in 1973. And he still has a great many followers among free market economists like myself. And as I said, there's a whole institute in Auburn, Alabama, the Mises Institute. And I just lectured there for a week. We have a week-long mini university every summer with 100 or so students from all over the world. We had students from Brazil and Slovenia and everywhere this summer in Auburn, Alabama. So that's in a nutshell, that's something about Ludwig von Mises. He's probably his most famous student is Friedrich Hayek, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1974.
Well, the reason I bring this up is, like I say, the way that I discovered him was via Ron Paul, who I followed for years and been a fan of. I did a little rant on Ron yesterday. And so that's how I became aware of him. But just give us a couple of points that were capsulized some of the ideas of Mises.
Well, he was involved in great debate over socialism in the early 20th century. And he wrote a book in 1922 called Socialism, a big fat book. And one of the things he taught the world, and he was right about this, is that you really can't have a viable economic system that works unless you have private property and socialism. Abolition of private property has always been the defining characteristic of socialism, and market prices, because market prices reflect the intensity of consumer demand and also the scarcity or non-scarcity of a product. And so when something gets more expensive, it gives us a signal. It tells us cut back on our consumption. It's more expensive, like gas or anything like that. And at the same time, when something gets more expensive, it tells producers, businesses, there's money to be made here. We should produce more. So they give us more, and that'll end up, you know, dropping the price eventually. And that's how markets work. Adam Smith might have called it the invisible hand in his famous book, The Wealth of Nations, published several hundred years ago. But there's nothing invisible about it or magical. It's how the marketplace works, and Mises explained that. And then the key is you can't have a viable economy without private property and markets. And then 70 years or so later, even some of the most prominent socialist academics, like Robert Heilbronner, admitted that he was right all along. But of course, they admitted that 70 years too late.
And everything you just described that you said,
right,
just makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's like on the front of your book, Ben Carson has a quote, "Economics is not brain surgery." That wasn't like mind-blowingly brilliant deductions. That everything you just said just seems like, yeah, I get that. That all makes sense.
Yeah, the theme of the book is be your own economist. Don't rely so much on the talking heads on TV or the New York Times columnists and so forth, because there's a long tradition of common sense economics that you don't need a graduate degree to understand. And so my book is written in the language of this whole series of politically incorrect books, and that I'm attempting to be engaging, and any reasonably educated person can get a lot out of it. And I recommend dozens of books all throughout the book, and there are little boxes in the book that says a book you're not supposed to read. And I recommend these books for you if you want to educate yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a copy of it in my hands right now. And there's these little blocks. It says a book you're not supposed to read. And I turn to a page. It's got one of your books on it. It's a fun way. It's almost like, the books for dummies. I can't remember, Car Repair for Dummies. It's written in a way that it's not intimidating. And you make a point that a lot of times, unfortunately, politicians know that people don't know anything about economics for the most part. The man in the street, you know, he knows how much his rent or his mortgage is and how much his groceries cost, but larger economic theory he may or may not know, and they take advantage of that.
Yeah, economists call that rational ignorance. You know, we We spend most of our time doing our jobs, raising families, paying the bills, and so forth, and really relatively little paying attention to what government is up to. And of course, government is so big and gargantuan, and no human mind could possibly comprehend even one millionth of 1% of what governments do these days. And so, and the politicians do take advantage of that. A good example would be Joe Biden, yesterday or the day before, going on TV and claiming that inflation was zero. And to the rationally ignorant person, and I'm not being insulting, that's just the way the world is. They might have thought, oh, good, Joe Biden has solved inflation. But what he meant was, you know, the inflation rate, when they talk about it, it's an annual average. And then the government says it's 8.5% right now, which means one month it might be 20%. Another month it might be 0%, but the average is 8.5%. And it just happened to be close to zero in July. And so Biden was touting that. But I think he intentionally said that because he knew that the people that Rush Limbaugh used to call low information voters, but yes, the economists call them rationally ignorant voters, would think, oh, good, no more inflation. I can fill up the tank now for a dollar. And that's how they play us.
Thomas, I'm going to take a break. We're at the bottom of the hour, so we're going to run a minute or two of news, and we will be right back here on TNT. This is Deprogram. I'm your host, Michael Parker. We'll be right back.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. Author Salman Rushdie was stabbed on stage in upstate New York 33 years after he was threatened with death by Iran for writing the book Satanic Verses. Donald Trump claims it is a hoax to suggest FBI agents were looking for documents related to nuclear weapons. Thames Water has texted customers in North London, Oxfordshire, and Surrey warning them of low pressure, dry taps, and rationed bottled water if they need it.
Free speech is in our DNA.
Experimental vaccines will never change that.
Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Yeah, even there. Never miss out on the news and views of the big issues of the day. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio.
Or download the TNT Radio app for free.
From the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
I speak with Thomas DiLorenzo, and we're talking about his brand new book. We're also talking about this Inflation Reduction Act. I don't know if the vote has gone through today. It was certainly, I think, coming up for vote today, and we're going to see. I mean, I'm sure it's going to pass. But Thomas, in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to have a guy on. He's a specialist in statistics, and his whole point is, you know, how you use statistics to tell whichever story that you want to tell. And, you know, politicians do this all the time. So, you know, you were talking about the inflation rate, because last month, I think it was 9.1. So this month, it's 8 or something. I've got to be honest, I'm skeptical. Whenever they start quoting numbers, they talk about unemployment figures, and then you dig into unemployment figures. So I think a lot of people, these rationally ignorant people, are the low information voters. I think they're just so turned off because they have a creeping feeling that however this information is conveyed to them, it's probably not completely solid, and they've just tuned it out. I'm not saying that people should do that. I'm just saying that I think that that is the view that a lot of people take.
Well, it is. And the more they lie to us, the more people will just ignore things like this. There's a group called a website called shadowstats.com, and they use the formula that the government used in the 1980s to calculate inflation. And according to that formula, it's more like 15% and not 8.5% as the Biden administration claims.
That's shadow stats?
Yes.
I'm glad you just said that, because Thomas, that has been what I've, and not just me, it's not my original thought, but a lot of people have thought, no, man, it's probably around 15%, maybe even more.
Yeah. I like chicken legs. I used to buy them for 49 cents a pound, but, you know, in the big packages. I went to the grocery store yesterday, and they were $5 a pound for chicken legs.
Yes.
And so, you know, do your own inflation accounting when you next time you go shopping, and try to remember what you paid for these things a year ago.
Well, Thomas, that's a good point, because when people hear these figures and they go, well, wait a minute, no, I was just at the store. And you're right. Chicken, interestingly enough, a lot of things have gone up. Chicken in particular has gone up a lot. We may have to do some whole shows about that, because there have been some fires at these chicken farms and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. But generally, you're right. People can, They don't need to turn on the TV. They could tell just by their shopping cart and filling up their tank how bad things are.
Yeah, what the government does is they have hundreds of items that they put when they calculate the consumer price index that we spend our money on. But of course, you know, I don't buy 300 different things in a given month or anything like that, but they have more than 300 items in there. And so, you know, you can do your own calculation of your inflation rate and see how much, you know, the things that you buy when you go shopping have gone up in price. And don't rely on the government's statistics.
Another thing, and I don't mean to skip around, but I just have a couple of points I wanted to talk about, and we will return to this bill because at some point we got to talk about these 87,000 agents, which concerns me. But you have a funny sentence in one of the chapters about the Fed, and essentially I'm paraphrasing, but what you say, the Fed is essentially a legalized counterfeiting operation.
Well, it is. What else would you call it? I used to tell my students that basically, you know, if you were to go down in the basement of your house and print out money and then go on campus and spread it around, you have a good old time, go out bar hopping and things, you know, you could go to prison for a very long time for that. But it's basically, but if you call it monetary policy, you're good. You know, you're safe. Just call it monetary policy. And that's basically what the Fed does. It creates money out of thin air and it buys and sells bonds with this in the bond market with this money that it just makes up. And what else would you call it but legalized counterfeiting?
I agree. And unfortunately, that's another one of those things that I think mostly, you know, not all people, but there's a lot of men in the street, men and women in the street. They're like, wow, it's one of those monolithic things. We don't really understand it. It's probably part of the government and they're probably not doing everything they say they are, but I don't understand it. Well, actually, it's not part of the government. And it's pretty crucial to the way the whole thing works. And they're trying to slow down the economy right now by raising, you know, the interest rates and everything. But here again, back to Ron Paul, he's from the get-go, he always said, you know, audit the Fed. That is never going to happen. Even my dad, who's a brilliant businessman and done very well for himself, wasn't given much to start off, but he's still, you know, he's like, well, you know, the Fed's important. And, but a lot of people think that.
It is important. It creates boom and busts in the economy over and over and over again. It has been for quite a long time. And, but it's not that hard to understand. I mean, a lot of what it does, you know, uses this language like quantitative easing. What the heck is that? Who knows what that is about? But it's all intentional to keep us in the dark, I think. And as far as Ron Paul goes, you know, if it really is in the public interest, you know, what the Fed does, well, why can't the public take a look at what it does? You know, whenever someone like Ron Paul recommends, let's audit the Fed, then, oh my goodness, you know, the entire banking industry is up in arms over it. They lobby, they take out ads, and it's a disaster. We can't do that. And yet the Fed is owned by stockholders, but the chairman is always appointed by the president. And so it is sort of a, you know, half government, half private organization. It's another cartel run by the government for the benefit of bankers. In this case, I call them banksters once in a while. But we have other examples of that in history that I write about in my book also, of government sort of being the cartel manager for economic monopolies or cartels. And the banking business is one of them.
Well, let's go down through a few of those, because you're also a big critic of FDR and his work. So you have the floor.
I mean, FDR is known to be, you know, he seemed to have the reputation of being anti-business because he started up all these regulatory agencies. But the First New Deal did was to impose price floors on everything in agriculture and manufacturing, that is, minimum prices. They had this harebrained idea that low prices caused the Great Depression. Therefore, if the government were to force higher prices, the Depression would end. And of course, a lot of the businesses kind of like that because, you know, if they were to conspire, if they were to get together and say, hey, let's raise the price of our television sets or whatever, well, that'd be a violation of the antitrust laws. They could go to prison for that. But if the government does it, it's okay. And that's what Roosevelt did. He forced up the price of everything. And of course, people cut back on their buying, as they always do when things get more expensive. And Roosevelt hired thousands of police, price code police, to fine people for cutting their prices during the Great Depression at a time when that's exactly what they should have been done. You know, we had long food lines and people starving to death, and the government is pushing up prices, and they were paying ranchers to not raise cattle because they wanted to raise the farm cattle ranchers' income. And by raising the price of meat, they paid farmers for not growing corn, or they forced them. They said they had acreage allotments, said you can only grow 100 acres, even though you own 1,000 acres. You can only grow corn on 100 acres because we want to push the price of corn up. And that all made the Great Depression worse, not better, and longer lasting as well.
That's artificial scarcity created for the lamest idea. And to me, that sounds like a reflection of, you know, now some people say, Park, you got your tinfoil hat on, but I think that's part of what's happening right now.
Yeah, it is. That's what I meant when I said, you know, letting politicians control prices is the worst economic idea in the world. And Roosevelt was the maestro at that.
Yeah.
And it was a disaster. You know, the unemployment rate at the beginning of the Great Depression, 1929, was 2.9%. By 1939, after the whole New Deal was in place, it was still 17.2%, almost five times higher than it was at the beginning. And so it was a big flop. And how on earth people are taught in school that Roosevelt saved us from the Great Depression is remarkable, because the numbers don't lie. And those are even the government's own numbers that say unemployment was five times higher at the end of the New Deal than it was at the beginning.
Yeah, Roosevelt is a bit of an enigma to me, because some people celebrate the guy, and he had four terms, and I mean, I don't know. I don't really get it.
Well, his reputation was saved by World War II. By the time you get to 1940, his programs were a colossal failure. We still had, like I said, 17% unemployment in 1939, on the eve of World War II.
When you were talking about those kind of price police that he would send out to make sure that people weren't dropping their prices, what did they do? Did they imprison them? Did they penalize them financially? What did they do?
There was one famous case of a New Jersey tailor who was imprisoned for cutting the price of hemming a pair of men's pants. And it was mostly fines. And there were a couple of examples that you can read about in the history books of people actually going to jail for cutting their customer a break on price. And by the way, that was all ruled unconstitutional in 1935. The whole New Deal was in 1935. And so from then on, Roosevelt had a different tack. He concentrated on trying to push up the price of wages with the minimum wage law and legislation that benefited labor unions. But again, you're in the Great Depression, there's very high unemployment, and what businesses need to do is to tell their employees, listen, I'm paying you $5 an hour. At $3 an hour, I can stay in business and I can still keep you on the job, but at $3 an hour until the economy recovers. That was made illegal. It was made illegal to do a deal like that with a minimum wage law. And I'm not using real numbers. I just threw these numbers out as an example. And then when they empowered unions, the unions were able to raise wages. Good for you if you keep your job, but it caused a lot more people to lose their jobs because it just wasn't economical for employers in the middle of the Great Depression to hand out pay raises. They needed to do the opposite or go out of business. And so that's another reason why Roosevelt made the Great Depression worse, deeper, and longer lasting. It was over in Canada long before it was over in the U.S., and Canada didn't have these policies.
I'm speaking to Thomas DiLorenzo. We're talking about his brand new book. We're going to take our final break of this hour. This is TNT's Deprogram. We'll be back.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
We've made a very serious discovery. If you look at CFACT, I published an article on correlation there. I guess it's a blog nowadays. But the serious discovery is there is a direct correlation between the increase in the price of postage stamps and CO2. Obviously, the increase in postage stamps is causing increasing temperatures and increasing CO2. So the solution is get the price of postal stamps down. Here's another ditty. More people get sunburned and melanoma in the summer. More people also eat ice cream cones during the summer. What does this tell you? We've got to get rid of ice cream. This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist and ice cream lover, Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, reminding you to enjoy your ice cream cone and the weather before someone takes both of them away from you.
It's not just a music box. It's a ballerina's castle. It's a place to keep special things. It's noticing the letter. It's hearing it's for her mom. It's the moment you realize a 10-year-old girl has come to terms with her terminal illness. It's telling her how brave she is. It's agreeing to pass the letter on after she's gone. It's not just a music box. It's one of the most important tools we use. Social work with children and families is changing. Join us. Call 0300 123 1220 or search Be the Difference.
As Joe Biden negotiates his way out of the room,
we don't negotiate with the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The Inflation Reduction Act is not going to reduce inflation, but it's going to do some other things. And Thomas DiLorenzo is my guest this hour. So we've got to ask the $64,000 question about the 87,000 IRS agents. Thomas, what was their rationale for why they need these, and what do you think they're going to do with them?
Well, of course, they always say they want to tax the rich more, but that's baloney, because the income distribution is diamond shaped. That is, most of the money is in the middle. You know, yeah, there are some very wealthy people at the top and some very poor people at the bottom, but the big money is in the middle. People who make between $50,000 a year and $200,000 a year. That's where you're going to get the money. And so when you hear about this, that's what this is about. And I think it's more insidious than this. I think because they're planning on arming a lot of them, putting a lot of them in the criminal division of the IRS. I read somewhere on the internet that they're planning on arming 70,000 out of 87,000, something like that. And I actually wrote an article that I sent around to Fox News. I don't know if they're going to print it, but I reminded my readers in this article that, you know, we fought an American Revolution partly over the existence of an army of armed tax collectors. One of the complaints in the Declaration of Independence was that King George III had sent swarms of armed tax collectors. Jefferson didn't say armed tax collectors. He said to eat out our substance. And we got rid of that with the Revolution. And then after the Revolution, however, Alexander Hamilton, who was the Treasury Secretary, imposed a tax on whiskey. And Western Pennsylvania farmers revolted. They thought they were discriminated against because, you know, why is there no special tax on tobacco or rice or these other things? Why us? Because they're using their grain to make whiskey. They were even using whiskey as money in Western Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And so Hamilton convinced George Washington to march 13,000 men up into Western Pennsylvania to put down the Whiskey Rebellion. And it turns out it was a big failure. George Washington went home. They put two of the tax protesters on trial, and George Washington pardoned both of them. And so we got rid of an army of tax collectors for a second time. This was in the 1790s. And so fast forward today, and here's Joe Biden wanting to bring back an army of armed IRS tax collectors and put it on the population. And it's an outrage. I think some of the people in the administration have the idea that this could be the kill shot to the First Amendment, because, you know, if you criticize the Democrat Party, you may get a visit by armed IRS agents threatening you over something you did. Yes. Why else would they want to have so many guns and so many armed tax collectors?
So it will be yet one more weaponized portion of the government. I mean, what you just said is what most people think. It's like, well, wait a minute. So now if I'm not on board, with the DNC narrative or whatever it is. Now I'm going to get a knock on the door. And there is some history for this, as you mentioned, and even recently in the past decades, you know, people have gone after their political enemies through the IRS.
Of course. You know, remember Obama's head of the IRS audited all these conservative groups, including the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., but not one left-wing group. And so that was the weaponized IRS is nothing new. Nixon did it. Johnson did it. They've done this. It's been a tool of government for a very long time. I just read today that some of the Pennsylvania state legislators who questioned the vote count in the presidential election were visited by FBI agents yesterday. And they weren't charged with anything. And they said, we're not investigating you, but we're just checking up on you. So they're intimidating. So I think, I suspect a lot of these IRS people will be intimidators. And you wouldn't have to intimidate everybody. You just have to have a few high-profile visits to people who spoke up against the Democrat Party. And a lot of other people will get the message. Keep your mouth shut.
Well, precisely. I don't see how we interpret any other way. And that's concerning to me. And the other thing that bums me out about this is it's going to pass. And, you know, and there's Republicans that are going to sign it. And listen, I'm not playing favorites here. I lean right. But, you know, there's the Republicans that I don't have any confidence in. And, you know, so. But I guess we're going to do this anyway.
As you should. Well, you know, the House of Representatives has the power of the purse. And so even if they do pass this, it is possible that a future Congress can just defund it. But like you said, you know, we have to rely on the Republicans, and they're not very reliable.
No, they fold like a cheap suit frequently. And that's what I'm concerned about. So we'll see what happens. Tell me what else, because we got a few more minutes. Let's go through some more fundamentals. Okay, the man in the street, we've already talked about how typically politicians will take advantage of their not full understanding of economics, even though most of us took it in college or have, you know, some knowledge of it. But what else do just the regular guy need to know that you put across in your book and why people should read this?
Well, it's all about, I have 15 chapters all about why and how markets work. And also, I have a discussion in quite a few chapters of how I quote a Wall Street investor named Doug Casey as saying that most of the economic commentators that you hear are really what he calls economic witch doctors. And he says they're basically propagandists for bigger government and more power in government, and they're not real economists. And so I take on a lot of the arguments in this book that have been made over and over and over again about the supposed failures of the marketplace and civil society and the free market. And I debunk those. And at the same time, I explain why government always fails at just about everything it does. And I explain why in government, failure is success. The worse the kids do in school, the more money we give to the public school.
Yes.
The more people who are in poverty, the more money we give to the poverty agencies. The higher is crime, the more money we give the police. And so the worse you do, the more money you get. In business, it's the opposite, of course. The worse is your product, the less money you get. And so there's this built-in incentive that I explain in the book of why we should expect government always to fail far worse than the market. The market is not perfect. Human beings are not perfect. It's not nirvana, but it's a lot less imperfect than government bureaucracy. And that's one of the main themes of the whole book.
It's funny, as you were describing that, I was thinking in my head, I had a candidate who's running for local government here in a recent primary that we had in June. And because I'm in Los Angeles, one of the big subjects that we talk about all the time is homelessness. And that subject came up and we were talking about the issues with homelessness. And he called it the homeless industrial complex for the exact reason that you just said, which is like, actually, they want big homeless numbers because that creates more money to go into this.
It justifies their job. You know, I did a radio interview in Seattle yesterday and he said the exact same thing. the radio host said, I think it was King County, Washington. They just set up a big new bureaucracy to deal with homelessness. And he was rattling off the job titles. And it sounded to me like all these government bureaucrats are going to be able to buy much nicer homes for themselves with all the money they're getting paid by the taxpayers. And of course, if they solve the problem of homelessness, they're out of work. And so why would you think they had an incentive to solve the problem any more than they had an incentive to solve the problem of poverty in America, even though they declared war on poverty in the 1960s?
Yeah, it's funny. Another thing that has been on our radar as of late was this whole idea that Biden might, remove the student loan debt that a lot of these people had accumulated. And, of course, we do this right before the election, of course. But the question then becomes, and it's coming up more and more, okay, so if you do that, well, what about the people who've already paid off the loans? When do you start it? When do you stop it? And to me, what that really says is that the universities are just going to rub their little claws together and go, well, we could charge even more now because these people aren't going to be responsible for the bills that they have to pay. Somehow it's going to be taken care of by the government, which doesn't fix anything. It actually makes the problem worse. I could be wrong, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, they'll just get the Fed to counterfeit more money to pay off all the bankers who made these loans in the first place. And that'll create even more inflation. And so they're not going to forgive the loans. I mean, they're turning all these students into freeloaders at the expense of other people in society. And then the question becomes, well, why don't you forgive, how about car loans? Why just this one type of loan is forgiven? Why not have a law that forgives people who bought an electric car? Let's say I went out and bought a $70,000 Tesla and maybe 10,000 other people did. Maybe they'll forgive that loan. But they're not really forgiving it. Somebody's going to pay it. The money, it doesn't just disappear. And the somebody, one way or another, is you and me and all the other taxpayers, either through inflation or higher taxes, or if the government borrows, then interest rates will go up and we'll pay that way.
My final question before we get out of here, it's like, and listen, I'm not trying to bag on Biden all the time, but he doesn't leave me any choice. And it's like, we didn't have these situations. It wasn't this bad a few years ago. If you were to point to one single bad Biden policy that has led to all of this, of which, there's several, but which one would you think would be the worst idea that Biden has brought to the table and enacted? I have a clue what I think it is, but I'd like to hear what you think it is.
Well, I think trying to shut down the energy industry is insane. And shutting down the Keystone Pipeline and restricting offshore drilling and oil leases and everything like that. I'll tell a quick story of an old friend, the late Murray Wiedenbaum, who was President Reagan's advisor. He worked at Washington University in St. Louis, and there was a famous environmentalist on the faculty. And he said to this environmentalist, Barry Commoner was his name, he said, you guys are against oil, you're against natural gas, you're against nuclear, you're against coal, that you can't have a capitalist economy without energy. And he said, Barry Commoner just sat back and smiled. And it like, yeah, that's the whole point. And that's Biden's point too. And they want to destroy the economy and create something different, the Green New Deal, whatever that is. But they have to first destroy what exists. And that's why he did this. So that's why he shut down the Keystone Pipeline and other sources of energy as well.
Thomas, that's my read. Exactly. Ladies and gentlemen, Thomas DiLorenzo. Thomas, tell people where to find out all the information about you. And if you're on any kind of social media platforms, if you're on, have a website, anything like that.
You can buy the book on Amazon. That's the easiest place to get the book. And I'm a columnist for lewrockwell.com. It's a man's name, L-E-W, rockwell.com. And you can find a lot of my writings there. And there are hundreds of articles that I've written over the years on that website.
Thomas, I'd love to have you back because today we're talking about economics. But when I was going through your bio and I saw the other subjects that you discussed, you've got books about Lincoln. I would love to do a show on that and get your take on that. So we've got to get you. When I saw the other subjects that you discussed, you've got books about Lincoln. I would love to do a show on that and get your take on that. So we've got to get you scheduled again in the future.
Oh, sure. Be my pleasure. Just give me a holler.
I appreciate it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming up on the end of the hour. That was Thomas DiLorenzo. Please buy the book. It is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics. It's a fun read, and it's written in a way that's not going to overwhelm you. It's not going to be like college. We'll be right back.